I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to Series 3 of The Legacy Tapes, a series of podcasts exploring how to leave something lasting in the ephemeral medium of theatre. My name is Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and today I'm talking with Richard Twyman, the Artistic Director at English Touring Theatre. Richard began his career as a freelance director, and he worked in all the big name companies, including 5 years at the RSC, before joining the Royal Court as Associate Director, Brackets International. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
So this is interesting because it's the first time that I've talked to two successive leaders of one organisation.
Wow, yeah.
So I'm really curious to see how the kind of the two conversations compare, because I think we don't ever get to do that, like hold up what people say about their vision and really kind of examine how it changes with new leaders. You've been here about a year?
Actually 2 years.
Two years?
I just had my 2 year anniversary.
Congratulations.
That really flies by.
That went really quick.
Yeah.
How's it been?
It's been incredible. I mean, that first year is such a kind of stretch of one's knowledge, abilities, everything, and you find yourself doing things that you, as a either freelance director or as an associate in a building, have just not come across. And so there's a huge amount of learning going on, and then of course you've inherited program and all of that, so it really feels like that first year is about just establishing what the company is and how it's making work at that point. And then that second year onwards is how you start to change it.
Figuring out what you want to do.
Yeah, but it's been an extraordinary journey and privilege to be here. And I think we're entering into a really exciting time. So that feels really positive.
Good. What was the, just out of curiosity, nothing to do with legacy, what was the thing that kind of you hit more like, oh crap, I never came across that as an associate?
Well, I mean, on day one, because of the time of year it was, we were entering into that Arts Council MPO 4-year strategy. So I mean, it's probably everyone says that, but that was, you know, you've been involved in various fundraising things, but that is a whole other thing. And it was literally handed to me on day one and said, right, in 2 months you're gonna have to finish this.
Write this.
And that was an enormous thing, because partly at that stage you also don't have a relationship with the Arts Council, so you don't know, like literally it's a blank page in terms of where the company is at, where you think they should be at, what did your main funder think that the company should be doing, and you have to start to craft and shape that vision in a way that you believe can move the company forward.
Had you written like project grant or grant for the arts before
exactly
and stuff
that. Yeah.
Okay,
exactly.
So all of a sudden it's like the Uber grant.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well, you're still here, so
still
well
here,
done.
Yeah. So
got
far,
it
so good.
Got it done. And was there like, because I guess especially at that moment of kind of writing this agenda for the next 4 years, you must be so aware of kind of anything that you want to, any pivots you want to make. Were you aware of like a legacy that you were inheriting that felt like a thing you really needed to carry forward? Like, what were the things you needed to carry?
I think that's the challenge for anyone coming into an organization is how much do you sort of, you know, burn and start again, and how much would you be absolutely insane? And you're obviously guided through that. You learn a lot through the interview process in terms of the board and their relationship to the previous incumbent, and you yourself in terms of when you've been applying and where you think the company should go. You've got ideas there, so there's an interesting negotiation that is happening. I mean, I suppose for me, it was an interesting thing, because I'd seen English Touring Theatre's work when I was an assistant director working regionally. I was a long placement at York Theatre Royal, and I remember the company coming in a couple of times whilst I was there, and what an event it was and how important it was in the programming of that theatre, as it was for a vast number of theatres. And then similarly through one's career, being aware of how important touring theatre is for so many artists, coming from diverse backgrounds and often outside of London and not necessarily from artistic backgrounds, you know, in terms of a family or if you'd seen theatre, and often it was that one touring show that came in that inspired that individual to apply to drama school, whatever it might be.
I absolutely have that story.
Yeah, it's maybe at some point we need to do like a kind of collation of that, because it's extraordinary how many people I talk to. So I was sort of very aware on a personal level of, and in many other ways, of the sheer importance of touring. But I personally had obviously been working at the Royal Court in the International Department, and my focus had been totally elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it was literally the rest of the world. And actually, I wasn't travelling within the UK for a good...
What's going on?
Exactly. That was a good 4 or 5 year period where I wasn't. And the shift for me was, I was applying for this job, and actually, I think I was offered it in the week of the Brexit vote. And I remember very clearly going to work at the Royal Court the next day, and everyone being in total shock, and personally feeling incredibly guilty, going, I've had all that. Like, there I was doing really political, I thought, right on well. I thought telling international stories is the single most important thing I felt I could be doing as an artist. And there's still a part of me that, you know, really believes that.
And while you weren't looking, Britain fell apart.
Exactly. Yeah. And I remember a lot of people, actually, interestingly, and I think they probably very quickly changed their minds, and I won't know names, but sort of immediately went, oh, well, you know, London's got to clearly go on its own now. And I remember sort of, because of the weird thing of going for an artist director of a touring company, exactly that point, sort of having this deep instincts of going, no, that is absolutely not what I personally should be doing as an artist, what we should be doing. We've got to do the opposite. We've got to get out there and start talking to people and hearing what people are saying and why we've got to this point and what's happening and telling stories and all those sorts of things. And that then, that was the big shift for me, where this went from being a sort of a company that I'd, you know, seen as an audience member, but didn't know a huge amount about and wasn't sure that I'd necessarily be the right person to be running it or anything like that, to going, still don't know if I'm the right person, but there's something that I artistically really believe is fundamental about what this company does. And I suppose then, going back to your earlier question about what you try and take forward, I think what was so extraordinary about Rachel's time here was her absolute commitment to audiences outside of London and to getting work out on the road. And that is just, I think, whoever's in this company, whoever's at English Touring Theatre, that is the thing that's got to happen. And how you do that, I think, is totally up for grabs. And of course, it's a really interesting shift, because as well, it's the first time a company in the UK was led by a producer. This company, touring company, was led by a producer, and it shifted back to having an artistic director. So there were inevitably going to be huge differences in terms of how we programmed and the work we were doing. I mean, the other thing that felt really fundamental was, so as well as Rachel's advocacy for touring, an absolute passion for it and for audiences outside of London, there was something really significant about how she looked after artists and actors and those that were touring, and the sort of really pastoral side of ETT. I think ETT were a real industry leader in that, and that felt really essential. That we didn't, that the, you know, that bit of bathwater wasn't
thrown out.
But, you know, and the pace of change, interestingly, for a touring theatre, I think, is potentially a little bit slower, because you're booking tours about a year in advance. It's just the nature of how, you know, mapping together a mid-scale tour works. So it takes a little bit longer to start to get one's, you know, programming ideas and into the mix. And the other thing as well is, you're not learning about one audience. You're potentially learning up to about 50 audiences. I mean, I think in my first year here, full year, we toured to, I think it was something like 34 different cities. So if you think of the you know, how specific a lot of these communities are that we're going to, and the range of audiences, is you're not learning about one audience in a borough in London.
And how the hell do you speak in a register that all of those people will enjoy?
Exactly. And I think that's one of the big challenges of this company is, for me, my passionate belief is that we're a national touring company, and the fact that we're going to a really wide cross-section of the country is fundamental. And that we're having national conversations is fundamental. That's a part of what we're doing, and the work, I think, is so key. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that later. But as we know, sometimes the best way of doing that is to be really local.
Yeah.
and it's how do you be a national local company?
Yeah.
That I think is probably the big challenge going forward.
Okay. So then my question is, what are the new, because I have lots of questions that are going to come out of that. But I'm just going to ask the partner question, which is, what did you want to bring that was new?
Yeah. Well, it felt, a couple of areas. So I suppose I had a conversation, a bit of name dropping, but I had a conversation with Carol Churchill quite early in my time here.
I mean, if you're going to drop a name.
It's a good one to drop.
It's got to be that one.
So, yeah. One of the great privileges of working at the Royal Court with some of the
you
people.
You could have done it slightly better. You could have been like, I had this chat with Carol Churchill, you know. Anyway, sorry.
I was asking her about, you know, because a lot of her early plays, obviously, were done at joint stock and were made and built, you know, with the intention of touring, and they did. A lot of them didn't even come to London, actually, initially. And she was fascinating. She totally turned my thinking on its head, because she said when we were making that work in the 70s, 80s, we believed that touring was the most radical thing you could do.
Mm.
And that actually London was a bit whatever.
Yeah.
Whether it was too capitalist or too past it or too saturated or too commercial, whatever it was. And it was that belief that actually, by going out on the road and meeting different audiences and by telling stories that are connecting disparate groups of people mm-hmm. all over the country and finding common threads and common language and all of that, that is a radical act.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I found incredibly inspiring, and is something that I would like to bring to this company.
Mm.
And that takes evolution. We're not there yet, although some elements hopefully have started to bubble in that direction. But I would like us, in terms of artistically, to be a company that is making work that is genuinely more radical and exciting than the work that's happening in London, if that's not too ridiculous a thing to say. And that feels really important to me, that audiences outside of London have access to that. So that's one of the elements. And then the other thing is probably what I've talked about is work that is really engaged in the contemporary world.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a danger. I mean, so the other reason, when I was offered the job, I really questioned it, partly based on the name English Touring Theatre. Mm-hmm. I actually grew up in Scotland, and because my parents have English accents, I'd sort of had a slight English accent as a kid. Now I've obviously lost my Scottish accent. And it was something, being English was used as an enormous insult where I was. And it was something that I'd only moved to England when I was 18 and went to uni down here in Birmingham. And then around the Brexit vote, that word was being pulled in different directions.
Yeah.
And, it's such a loaded word. And when I was working internationally, I mean, that was an extraordinary thing. You describe yourself British, English, whatever it might be. I had a response in, I think, three of the countries I visited, which was, oh, you're English. That's all your fault then. And, you know, looking at our colonial legacy that we'd never like to look at, there's a lot of truth in that. And so for me, what I felt I couldn't do was run an English touring theatre where the English bit of that word felt reflective or retrospective or congratulatory or celebratory of a kind of past. For me, it's like we need to dive into that word and start to explore it and think of that Englishness as something that is fully inclusive, something that's representative, something that is radical, something that is moving forward. And that, you know, again, not something we're there yet, but that those sort of two principles are things
but
that I'd love
to. Being on the journey is worth it, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. Let's just talk a little bit about, there's so much stuff that you've talked about, because the thing that I hear the most actually about touring, as someone who occasionally produces for touring on the mid-scale, is that it's broken and it's all hopeless and oh God. And then the second thing I hear is, well, our audiences weren't like that. And I'm sort of curious. Recently I was chatting with the board of a theatre that you toured to with Othello. And they felt that was the edgy high end of art. And actually, like, I haven't seen the show. It might be, I don't know. But what it wasn't was somebody, you know, spinning from the ceiling with a laser butt plug, which is the other end of, of edgy kids.
Oh, you didn't see the show, we did have that.
Okay, oh, damn it!
No, I'm joking.
And so I kind of, one of the things that interests me with this, you know, talking about touring to people with different registers, talking to people with different registers, is how you manage that sense of the radical that you were talking about. Because radical in Wolverhampton, where I'm from, is very different to radical in Sussex or radical in Glasgow or wherever. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, these are the conversations we have every day here, and I'm sure we'll do for you know, all the time that Sophie and I are here. There's really complex stuff there. I mean, the first thing is similarly like you, if I had a pound for every time I heard the phrase touring is broken, or, you know, our audience wouldn't come to that, then I would be a very, very, very rich man.
You probably wouldn't need to tour.
You probably wouldn't need that. I mean, the thing I say rather flippantly to touring is broken, and I understand it because people who are saying it are often the artists, and what they're expressing is the incredible difficulty and financial burden that often they're shouldering. And so I don't mean to make light of that. But the thing that I often say in response is that it's not broken, it just needs a lot of subsidy. And it's just a choice that we need to make as a country, as a nation, as an artistic community, whether we believe touring is an important thing to be doing. Mm-hmm. And if we do, we have to subsidise it really properly, and I think a lot better than we're doing now. Yeah. And because it is expensive, and there's very clear reasons for that. It's expensive to move people around the country, and sometimes stay at home, and for all those things. And I mean that across, you know, from we're currently producing our first small scale tour for a long time, and the economics of it are insane in terms of the sheer cost, and imagining companies with much less subsidy and much more than us it's terrifying, the pressure that's being put on people. And I equally know, having spoken to a lot of venues, that the things they're suffering from are regional theatres. So for me, there's like, and touring is only one aspect of it, but for me there needs to be a real radical shift in terms of how we subsidise nationally, and the portion of money that goes to London, etc., if you know, whatever it might be. But yeah, so for me, I'm on the camp that I think touring is absolutely fundamental to what we are as a country, and to and the work we should be making, and both historically the work that we've come from and how theatre began in this country and its legacy going all the way back to those, you know, medieval mystery plays, whatever it might be, and just but also in our desire to not be parochial, to not be enclosed, and all those things. I think it is so fundamental. I just think we need to give it more subsidy. And then the second thing about what was the second part of that?
Just bouncing off what you just said, that desire to not be parochial. Because I, you know, I'm from Wolverhampton, which is, I love you Wolves, but deeply parochial in many ways. There isn't a pride in a cultural offering that comes from that place for lots of complex reasons. And some people quite like being parochial. Some people identify themselves as not in dialogue with the wider world. So it's just that, like, how do you talk to those people as well?
Yeah, I mean, God, the reasons for that are
you really might not have an answer.
No, I mean, it'd be hard to have one single answer.
Yes,
what's this?
Here it is. I figured it out.
I think. Oh gosh, I mean, I think one of the issues we have in this country, isn't it, is that our political, economic and cultural centre is the same place.
Yeah.
And what that does in terms of the drain on human resources, on financial, on all of that stuff is huge. And then, and we could talk forever, couldn't we, about the years of neglect that, you know, in industry and, you know, whatever that's happened outside London. And all of that, again, isn't to diminish any of the extraordinary work that's happening. And, you know, there's so much brilliant work out there. So I suppose I think one has to acknowledge that there are circumstances that make it really challenging. I mean, the flip side is that some of the ideas that I'd heard both from without and within the company when I joined around that question of, an audience won't want to see that, have really been turned on their heads. You know, I came in with a really open mind, not really knowing much better, apart from when I'd, you know, worked regionally as a younger director. And time and time again, I've been constantly surprised and excited by the audiences that we're meeting. Sure, there is a sort of a conservative audience member that is out there that is quite common to lots of cities.
That will complain about everything.
But more than that, there are so many more audiences with diverse backgrounds and experiences and openness to things. And I think, you know, ETC are nowhere near, as you say, with the Othello, nowhere near the radical end of the work that is being made.
That wasn't me being a dick.
No, I say the same thing myself, in terms of the radical work that's being made for audiences and that's really attracting people. So there's incredible hunger. I think it's about slight supply and demand issue, that there's probably just not enough work being made and being taken, so audiences aren't exposed to it in quite the same way. But I think there possibly, potentially, is a slight sort of patronising of audiences that has happened. And I think it's really exciting to see where that's turned around. I mean, I often think about Netflix, and I think about, you know, we talk a lot about audiences being very scared of new work. And yet every single night, millions of people are going on there and going, oh, what's that show?
With, like, deeply formally challenging visual imagery and, you know, completely non-naturalistic narrative. Like, amazing stuff is happening.
Exactly. And
try and do it in theatre and they'd be like, our audience don't like that.
Exactly. And so, yes, there's a challenge because they're in their own home and so it's easier and it's a much more affordable model and theatre is expensive. So there's issues we have to tackle. I'm not sure that the biggest one is the work being challenging. I really, in my experience, as audiences are really open. But there are tactics, you know, like we've, as I say, because we're evolving our programme this year, just so happened that we've done two and we've got a third coming of shows that are on the syllabus. And that was intentional and fundamental because when I came in, you know, a really large percentage of our audience were over 55. Now, we can't turn our back on the audience. We need them desperately. They're really significant. And also, we've got to remember that most of that audience grew up in the 60s, so they're probably more radical than any of us. It was absolutely fundamental. We were getting younger audience members in and more diverse audiences in, of course, that goes without saying. And doing stuff on the syllabus was really important. And so that was sort of how I began. What I realised when I started sitting in these auditoriums in Chelsea Walker's production Streetcar, which was really deconstructed and contemporary and challenging. What one would describe if we were thinking it was challenging for an audience and some of the venues we went to. And what I realised was that how fundamental it was having young people in the audience, because that 50 or 100 young people in each night meant that the rest of the audience, who might perhaps on the surface have found, I don't know, the Blondie track a bit incongruous or something, where in the end of that production it became really quite abstract in its visual language. If and I'm not saying it was, but if that was going to be a challenge for some of those audiences, not having seen work in that way before, it was the response of the young people around them that gave them the lenses, as it were, to see and appreciate that work and to totally enjoy it. And as a result, I think it's one of the most successful pieces of work we've done in recent years. And our feedback from it across all sections of audiences was phenomenal. And so hopefully that's carried forward with Othello. And I think for us, quite excitingly, the real test...
There are balloons in Othello, there's a punch bag.
I mean, there's all kinds of stuff.
All sorts of things.
And I think where the end of this little experiment is going to go to will be in Ned Bennett's Equus, which is coming up next year. And, you know, we know, you know, I'm sure listeners and audiences sort of know his work. And, you know, he's a phenomenal artist and he's really going to, you know, deconstruct and blow apart and do something really exciting with that play that's not been seen before. And that's going to be interesting. That will be taking stuff a step further and saying to some audiences who perhaps will not have been brought very much of that work. And I'm really excited to see what happens. And, you know, and then there's a, you know, I think for me, like, even within that, though, there's a part of my brain which is cautioning, because there is a total other way of looking at this, which is, you know, that production of Equus, you know, maybe isn't where the company needs to evolve to. You know, maybe it needs to actually evolve into something that is much more inclusive and is much more sensitive to different audiences, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there'll be something too London about that, in a way. So, but at the moment, in terms of the work we've been doing this year, in terms of diversifying, getting much younger audiences, making the work much more formally and artistically inventive, that feels a good place, and we haven't yet lost an audience. I mean, just mm-hmm. Anecdotally, but we were in Newcastle with Othello a couple of weeks ago. The National were there with another Shakespeare play that will remain unnamed, in the bigger theatre. We were there at Northern Stage, and we sold out for the entire week.
Yeah.
So, and in a way, that goes back to the first question about this crisis in touring, is that that's really true. It is unbelievably expensive. There isn't the support out there that there should be, and particularly it's true for new, you know, we've been doing this 25 years. We have a trust and a legacy that's been built up, and a lot of that is the extraordinary work that Rachel did here. But if you're a new company and you're, and they're the ones who are probably doing the work that is really going to push for and audiences, there just isn't the support at the moment. It's one of the reasons why we have this program called ETT Forge, which is a sort of a key part of trying to nurture and support touring at both the small and mid-scale. But yeah, we've found that we have got audiences for the work we're doing currently. And even in those cities that are traditionally a bit harder, we've found that they've been growing. The question mark is what happens when we take work which is really, really radical, or where we start to do stuff that is cross art form, that is new writing, and for me at the moment, where I'm, you know, 2 years into this job, is I'm having really big questions about what a touring theatre should be in the 21st century, and I don't have any answers at the moment, so please don't ask me.
No,
but and where we could go, and that I don't know about you know how that will fare. But.
So let's talk a little bit, because I think a lot about touring because it's the thing I do. One of the things that Rachel Briscoe from Fanshen, who I respect a lot, says often to me is that so much of our touring is focused around urban centres. And then if you're in one of those towns that's part of the conurbation, right, the satellite towns, you never get, nothing ever comes to you. And I think there's, so that's the thing, this sense of so much of, we think about touring to the regions, and what we mean is touring to other urban centres. The regions. Somebody should shoot me for saying that. But then there's also this truth that the biggest divide in Brexit, the first two kind of divides on how people voted were higher education, and then it's whether you're urban or rural. And rural touring is impossible, theoretically, because just of the travel logistics. So in that, frame your question, Rebecca, in that very complex and difficult landscape, if we want to talk to all of these people, because that's what you're talking about, right? You're talking about that kind of the finding of a unified voice for a nation, or at least a harmony, right?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, but okay. You, but go on.
That sounds quite fascistic in a way.
No, I don't mean that. I just mean finding the thing that can speak to everybody in somehow.
I suppose I'd just say allowing the conversations to happen, but letting those conversations to be happening on a national platform and across the country and all of that. But I think diversity of opinion is really key in there.
Well, I'm with you on that. I just mean, like, in terms of how we finding a way to frame a cultural, a cultural conversation that is speaking in the same language, because at the moment we're not, like, you know, there are things that I come to the table with, or that you might come to the table with, as assumptions that, you know, my sister doesn't come to the table with as an assumption, and that gap is where culture happens. So my actual better question is, how do we find a way to make sure that gap where the culture and the conversation happens includes people that aren't in cities? Is that is that a thing that worries you, or is it because mid-scale touring?
Yeah, it's huge.
Does it work in the region, rural places?
It's a massive thing, and actually, I mean, I suppose I think there are some extraordinary rural touring companies, and who are doing really brilliant work, and it's not something we've done before. Although one of sort of artistic associates at the moment, Elizabeth Freestone, formerly artistic director of Pentabus, and we've been having some really great conversations about trying to bring some of that knowledge into us, and whether it's something we could also sort of explore. In terms of that thing you're saying about the non sort of, let's say, affluent urban centres, or the non sort of those that don't have the really well funded, the few really well funded regional theatres that are out there, it is really the thing that keeps me up at night, because I think that's the thing that is most important about ETT, and I think it's the thing that makes ETT unique to some of the other well-funded subsidised touring companies. And we could happily tour to a select number of venues with, you know, relatively solid titles, and know that we would cover our running costs.
Yeah.
And we could do that four times a year, go to exactly the same cities. And that's not what we're here for or what we're funded about. The flip side, though, so something like Othello, for example, is a perfect example of something that does the other thing. I mean, listing the cities. We opened in Oxford because they were one of our co-producers. And obviously that's a very affluent city, and it did sell out there. It was like really worked. And the rest of the tour, you know, went to Harrogate, went to Doncaster, went to Huddersfield, went to Oldham, went to Poole, went to Cheltenham, went to Warwick, went to Newcastle. And I hopefully haven't missed anywhere. And just, you know, the stretch of sort of economic divide in those cities is remarkable, those at the one end compared to the other. And the range of lived experience in those cities is, you know, probably about as diverse as it can get within
Huddersfield to Oxford,
within the UK. Yeah. And it's absolutely fundamental that we find a way of keep going. So the way we were able to do that was through a strategic touring grant. So it was through real investment from the Arts Council. And I think that's what I mean about this subsidy. And it was part of a three-year strategy, and we've seen audiences over those 3 years. And it sort of has been the time from when I'd got the job to now that we've seen those audiences grow in almost every single one of those cities by well over 100%, through clever programming, through marketing initiatives, audience development things, through, and that is, so it just, it takes a lot of effort and time and a lot of subsidy up front. And I think there's no sort of magic to it, but it's just, we have to do it. I mean, we had a matinee, sorry, sounds a bit like we're blowing our own trumpet, and we shouldn't be, because there's loads of things we're not doing well enough at the moment, but, you know, we had a midweek matinee in Doncaster, and we paid to 450 people a few weeks back, and that is significant. And significant in terms of where we began. So there's something about work that is feeling relevant and engaged, and, you know, and there's something about work that's sort of directly speaking to people's lived experiences of the world today, and that's really important. So yeah, I don't think there's a magic answer. I think for us, where we've done it successfully is through real significant support and subsidy. And at the moment, that's obviously been the principle behind some of the work that the National's been taking on tour, and the Arts Council's funding of that. And I just think there should be much, much more of it. And I think possibly we should, I mean, we are sort of ultimately, but held accountable about whether we are or aren't going to some of those towns and cities. And for us, you know, we need to keep going. It's part of the idea now. Is that the 3 year that project's ended, is that those cities will be ones that we regularly still tour to. Now, we have to balance, because we're not living in a world, unfortunately, where we get significant guarantees from theatres.
Yeah.
So everything you do on tour is a risk.
Yeah.
And every tour is different. So it's like you're starting scratch, you know, from the beginning. You don't know how it's going to go. And the size of our company, one or two bad tours in a row would be disastrous. Mm-hmm. So there are... there are sort of responsibilities that we have to, you know, the company, but it's about being really, it's about learning the landscape, which, you know, 2 years in, I think we're just beginning to do, and the how widespread, you know, those 34 cities we went to, we started to learn about them, build relationships, and it's about a commitment to keep going to them. And keeping to grow and nurture those audiences.
And I guess there's also a sense of a demonstration effect, you know, like thinking about the theatres in... I have no idea about the theatre in Sandwell in Dudley, but it is the place that I'm talking about. Like, you know, the theatre there that sees the place, the theatre in Lichfield, doing a thing, doing something interesting and unusual and exciting that they then feel like isn't such a terrible risk. Because I think there's the risk to the company that tours that we talk about quite a lot. And then there's we talk a lot about the difficulty that that companies face in getting theatres to give guarantees, like you just mentioned. But if you, you know, if you're the person in charge of those theatres and you've got 146 grand for tiny NPO, and then you've got whatever the council give you and whatever people pay for their tickets, that's, you know, those numbers don't add up. So there has to be a way to kind of, that, you know, the gaps aren't just with the people making the art, the gaps are with the people receiving the art as well. And I guess I'm really curious what you think about how that subsidy should be spread, because basically this is your platform where you're like, give us all the money. That's your key talking point.
In my experience, a lot of those smaller, very local town venues are rightly so much more focused on participatory work and on work that's sort of really engaging the community, and that and actually a lot of those seem to be doing it really quite well. I think the gap is that I'm seeing at the moment is in that section of playhouses, those sort of 350 to 800 seat venues where that are just screaming out for work to fill their schedules, that is pushing their artistic identity forward as well. And that's where it feels the real dearth is. I mean, I think one thing I sort of mentioned earlier is I think we have to find ways of supporting new, younger companies to get up to the mid-scale in that sense. And whether that is, you know, guarantees against loss schemes from the Arts Council, whether that's, you know, more focused strategic touring granting like we've had, but has subsequently been changed, whether that's a company like ours taking responsibility to partner and nurture and work with those companies, whatever it might be, whether it's, you know, convincing venues to take what might be perceived as risk but very rarely is on those voices, you know, all kinds of stuff. But that, I think, is a huge resource that we have in this country that isn't quite yet being given the oxygen it needs to start to fill those theatres. So that would be one way. But yeah, and then you know, I've sat in a lot of round tables lately, and every solution is on the, you know, radical solution from cutting all the touring companies and giving all that money to the venues, to cutting the venues and actually giving all the money to touring companies and letting us sort of,
you getting everyone a tent,
you know, getting everyone a tent, you know, it sort of is, you know, everything in between, you know. You know, cutting all the funding in London, knowing that most of those theatres will be okay, and giving all that nationally. I don't know. I mean, there's obviously those things need much more nuance. But yeah, I think one way is by getting up, you know, new voices out there onto the circuit. I think would be fundamental.
Yeah. Also, because I just this last year I spent quite a lot of time with doing various stuff with theatres at that kind of, yeah, up to 800 seats, the kind of regional playhouses that may not have any NPO and like just getting by, or that, you know, the NPO kind of pays, you know, the CEO and exec salary really, and that's it. And one of the conversations that I come up against again and again and again is like, how do I pay the rent for the theatre? If I take this, you know, how do I pay the money I have to make on this week? And why would I risk that when, if I risk that, it's these 20 people's jobs?
Yeah.
When what I can do is program, I know, Ian Lee, and that will sell out. Or actually, really interestingly, program an amateur dramatic, a local amateur dramatic company who will totally sell out, will pay rent,
absolutely,
who are working, who actually have more money to spend than most professional companies because they're not paying people costs. You know, those. I feel like there really has to be a conversation about how we manage that pressure. Because there isn't even it doesn't matter if there's an appetite to push the envelope in terms of the artistry, because you daren't take the risk. Because if, you know, if it just happens to rain that day, you're buggered. Or it snows that week, or it whatever.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm just giving you problems. Please solve them all.
No. I mean, the reality facing venues is, as we know, is really extreme. And as you say, it is jobs. It's you know, it's jobs and livelihoods and keeping theatres lights on and all of that. I mean, I think there are positives in the ecosystem there in terms of the sheer variety of work that's then being made. I think work that is participatory and that is genuinely got engaged in local communities is really significant and important, and arguably something that the UK's, well, I don't know actually, but it's done in a slightly different way to Europe. And I think it's interesting how we're putting, hopefully beginning to put more resources and more attention to that work. Mm-hmm. Think of something like Pericles at the National recently. Mm. And I think that is a really, really good step. Of course, you know, a lot of regional theatres have been doing that work for decades.
Ever. And I'm like, fuck off, you patronising git.
Absolutely. So I think... there isn't a solution, and we know, you know, when I started in this industry in the early 2000s, and my first proper job was at York Theatre Royal, I think at that point they were programming 12 to 14 shows a year, including the Panto, in between the studio and the main house, that they were self-producing, and there wasn't even co-producing.
Yeah.
And we know the landscape now.
That sounds like utopia.
And that was true of the vast majority of the non-receiving houses, of the rep theatres, and... You know, now I'm not quite sure the statistics, but I suspect it'll be under 5. There is a huge... The flip side is I suspect there are probably a greater variety of audiences coming to the theatre in terms of what they're actually coming to see there and people coming to that building than perhaps there ever has been, because of, as you talked about, whether it's comedy or music or amateur groups being programmed. So, I don't know, there are audiences out there. I just think we have to be really inventive and clever about how we engage with them. And sometimes, that is through art and making the art better.
Yeah.
And that is a really, really valid way of doing it. And other times it's about being much more inclusive and open and generous in the offer and the conversation.
And sharing the glee. Yeah. Come and have some glee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I just wanted to ask a little bit about what, if you're aware of kind of, because this is supposed to be a chat about legacy, which it sort of is, what are you aware of a legacy that you're creating? Like, did you arrive, or do you have this thing, this picture that you want ETT to take shape into?
No, I think coming in, I probably was too ignorant of too many things to have a clear picture. I mean, there are definite like pole stars that you aim towards, and there are things and beliefs that you form and that are really significant. I mean, for me, I talked a bit about before in terms of the word English, and in having those conversations and you know, really, really, really diversifying the stories and the audiences and who's telling them. And that's so significant. And this thing of a national local conversation is really significant. For me, conversely with that, is that you couldn't do that and also not have an eye internationally.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I haven't worked out how to do yet, but I'm really keen to, is that experience and knowledge that I built up at the Royal Court working all over the world. Is how that can also, because wouldn't that be a glorious thing for English, for an English, something to be called English touring theatre, and also be telling international stories and engaging with the rest of the world? Like, that feels so fundamental at this point in time. So that's something which we haven't done yet. We're just beginning to explore international touring, and we're taking our first production abroad next year. But there's much further to go in terms of genuinely international co-production. You know, that would be something I would love us to get to.
Yeah.
And feels really important. Yeah. And is something that, you know, audiences get at the Barbican and maybe a few other spaces, but a lot of audiences outside of London don't have access to, and I see absolutely no reason why not. So there are things like that. I'd love 50% of our programme to be new work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this sense, isn't it, that we can only programme in a lot of these spaces. And this is, you know, where there is a slight sort of censorship, let's say, with how you book a tour, about what titles you can and can't do, or what will be booked and won't be booked. And we're beginning to push that now. And that's really interesting.
Mm.
Where I would like to be with that is that we can confidently program new work on the mid-scale outside of London and know that that won't, you know, cripple us.
Yeah.
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 So that's something. I think more probably the single most important thing that we could do whilst we're here is to try and change the industry attitude to touring.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a fundamental and enormous problem with how it's seen in various quarters. And some of those, you know, these aren't necessarily individuals' problems. You know, things like, you know, critics not having the resources to travel outside of London to see work.
Yeah.
Or I think some of it's the fault of the touring companies, as you say, perhaps only focusing on some of the more affluent urban areas, and therefore collecting audiences. Some of it might be to do with some of the work that's going around and its quality, and I think there's, you know, blame lied there. I think and you know, I think we need to become better at how we look after people on tour, mm-hmm. and making it an attractive thing to do. But I also think there are really, really significant issues with how the work is seen by agents and by some actors at the moment, really, to put it really simply. Casting a touring show at the moment is an extraordinary thing. If you ever wanted to make a documentary, that's what I suggest, is follow the casting process on a touring show.
I've done enough casting to never want to think about it ever again.
You will learn lot about how the rest of the UK is viewed by people. It's quite remarkable. And I think, and listen, I understand why. I mean, the cost of, as we know, a large majority of actors or directors, whoever it might be, are living and working in London, and the cost of living is so extraordinarily high that TV and film do often become, with families and with all of that, the only mm-hmm. option. I understand that agents need to make a living as well, and I can see that holding out for that TV offer and all of that, but the amount of times I meet and talk to actors who are so frustrated about the lack of work out there, and it's so hard to tally that with the reality of, you know, putting a list together for auditions and 90 out of 100 actors just having no interest whatsoever to, you know, the moment you say it's a touring show, phone down. And I wish there was a sense of responsibility at the moment. I wish there was a sense of that Carol Churchill thing about going out and making work for audiences outside of London is an important and is a radical thing to do. And is not, I'm not saying that touring is the solution to Brexit. That's what the headline of it should be. Tour to solve Brexit. But I mean, it's not gonna hurt, is it, to go out and find out what people are really living, what other people are really thinking, and to have conversations about that stuff. That was always the principle behind the international work that we were making at the core, that you can, through storytelling, through listening and telling stories, you can understand peoples and cultures that you perhaps had no direct experience of, but that through the act of that, you can understand humanity and bits about both yourself and about other people, and that can make the world, crudely, sounds a bit like, because music should just come in now, can make the world a better place for all of us.
But this, and, okay, so this is the thing, because I'm so with you. That's a conversation of reciprocity. It's like, here is the thing, here is my story, you tell me your story, we understand something, we find a commonality.
Totally.
Right? What we don't do, what we're really good at in this country, is taking our metropolitan liberal elite, sensibility out to the poor benighted regions. And no one ever, like, where is there are a few touring companies from not London.
Yeah.
Who do cast and recruit in not London. But the conversation, the cultural dialogue, is not reciprocal. It just isn't. So I think, because that's the thing that really kind of, I don't know, because I'm from a place that doesn't really know how to have its own pride in its local culture. In fact, almost the local culture is to be humble to the point of disappearing. But also I'm an adopted member of the Metropolitan Liberal Elite, so I spend my whole life torn between being like, just do what we tell you, from both sides, and then being like, well, hang on, why the fuck should anyone listen? You know, if I live in the northeast and I have seen my community crumble because of the policies of this place, and no one wants to hear me say that, and there is no space for anyone like me, who sounds like me, to say that, why should I let some other twat come and tell me what they think?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm just ranting. No, this isn't my fault.
But I totally agree, and it comes down, doesn't it, to the stories that we're telling and that we're putting our subsidy into and what we choose to tell. And I think all of us have to be better and more aware of that. And I think it goes back to that thing you're saying about there being real local engagement and locals' narratives and stories being told and opportunities. And I think that's where touring companies are useful as a kind of pollination, then, you know, that are able to be both local and national. I think that's what I mean by that. There is a kind of, fertilisation, pollination, whatever you want to call it, that is key. And I think a city's cultural offer, or in terms of theatre offer, can only exist with both things. I don't think it could be one or the other, and I'd never suggest that. And that's where I mean that so many venues are doing such extraordinary things in their towns. But I think we've got a real problem in London. I think, I mean, anecdotally, we're in Newcastle. There are two Geordies in the cast of Othello. One is actually not doing his own accent because he's playing Cassio, and he's playing, you know, and one is. And whenever the actor went on stage, he's doing his, and everyone else in the play is in their natural accents. I'm not that kind of director. But whenever the guy who's got his own actual accent came on stage, absolutely loved it. And just that idea of representation and seeing yourself on stage.
Yeah.
And it was so funny for the other actor.
One of them, goddammit.
But there's a serious point there in terms of, you know, within that cast, because of, you know, half the venues we toured to were in the north of England. That I think over half of the actors in that cast were from the north of England.
Yeah.
And that was intentional, you know, that was really, really significant. So I think it is about, you know, and also, probably haven't said it, but it wasn't, you know, it sounds, because we're talking about Othello here, so Shakespeare, so how, you know, Jesus. So, but what for me was important is it's an approach to Othello that explores his spiritual, religious, cultural identity in a way that hasn't been done in this country before. And in terms of the populations of a lot of the cities we were going to, we were finding ways of both the work doing around it and the way in, and even the post design and all of that was a way of trying to sort of open up. And I think whenever I do a classic like that, it's like going, why don't we just write a new play about this? And I think you have to be able to answer that question. And for us, what was significant was about going, whether we like it or not, there is a predominance of Shakespeare in the sort of cultural capital of this country, and the vast majority of people do not see themselves in there at all, and yet we have to study it, and it's on the syllabus and all of that. And how do you get beyond that? And so it was a way of going, there is sometimes something radical about within the form of that, hopefully, you know, setting a bit of a bomb off and going, oh, actually, no, someone, you know, this could be a Muslim character, actually, and therefore you could see yourself on stage in a sort of national culture, the more exactly. And it's for me, it says so much about us as a culture. This is me going back to my Royal Court days and our sort of myopathy around the rest of the world and different cultures, that's been buried in that play since it was first written, and no one in this country has ever explored that. And academics have talked about it, you know, there's amazing books, all of that, but it's just not something that's ever been gone to. And so I think, but sorry, I'm probably going off topic now.
No, it's interesting to hear the thinking, that's the point. Go off topic. You just said something about, I'm going to rein the conversation back in shortly, but you just said something really interesting about, and it's Shakespeare, and oh God, and you kind of stopped yourself because, and in my head, I kind of played through what the rest of that was, which is like, there's enough bloody Shakespeare out there, and that's what everyone thinks theatre is, and that's what stops everyone going.
Yeah.
But also, in my bedroom in Wolverhampton, where no one in my family went to the theatre apart from the pantomime, and Shakespeare, there was something about the glee in Shakespeare that was what I loved, and that was what got me into theatre, and especially in kind of north of the Midlands, north of Birmingham, there's such a massive autodidact tradition that really that we patronisingly forget exists, and we presume has disappeared, and I sort of think there's quite a lot of this. Like, people are fucking erudite north of the Watford Gap.
Yeah.
And even if they're not erudite, Shakespeare isn't about erudition, if it's done well. It's about gut and pulse, and, you know. Yeah,
absolutely.
So I just really wanted to say that for some reason.
No, you're absolutely right. And really huge political and social issues that, you know, are problems that we're still grappling with in society now, probably more so than ever. Yeah. And absolutely. And as a lens for that, it's really useful. I also think there's something as well in its form, that it's not a literal form. Mm. And actually seeing people today with that language, whatever they're dressed as, however it's being staged, is, unless you're doing it in a very particular kind of way, it's probably not literalism. Mm. And I think that's really significant in terms of the act of imagination, what theatre can be. Yeah. And I suppose it's more, it's the predominance, it's the amount, it's the...
it's the laziness of it.
Yeah.
Like, because sometimes it's brilliant and sometimes it's like...
But it can be, I mean, for us, it just became a useful vessel to get those audiences in, because they're studying it. Yeah. And, you know, I cannot describe how many young people saw that around the country. And that is really exciting because of their response to it. And, you know, we need to, as I said earlier, we need to do more new work as well. That's key. Mm. But, yeah.
Maybe not double bills. Come for 3 hours of Shakespeare and then have. I mean, I remember seeing a Midsummer Night's Dream at the RSC when I must have been about 13 or something, with Gisette Simon as Titania. And the Titania bottom sex scene was pretty damn, you know, raunchy. You believe that there were great noises. It was amazing. And there was I went as a school trip from, as a scholarship kid, at a girls' convent school, and everyone was quite embarrassed. But then the party in front of us was a school party, and they got up and left, because then their teacher stood up as one and said, class 14B with me, and off they went. And because this moment was so affecting, and that was the minute that I was like, oh, I'm gonna do this.
Yeah.
And so that I found that super, super interesting, that we think of Shakespeare as this thing that's, or any of the kind of classical plays.
And also, for me, it's about representation as well, as I wouldn't do any Shakespeare play at the moment. The ones I'm particularly interested in, the ones that have mean opportunity something. To open something out. And, but I am quite fond, I remember when I was at the RSC, there was a lecture set up, I think, with Adriana Chaplin, who is the writer in residence at the time of Michael Boyd. Or maybe it was not at the RSC, but they both spoken it around... Should there be a ban on Shakespeare for 3 years or 5 years or something? A moratorium. Yeah. And I'm quite a fan of that idea. I sort of, in quite an impish way, I think that would be really exciting.
It'd be interesting to see what people did instead.
Yeah.
Like, what's the thing in your imagination that you've never been able to do?
Yeah.
Been brave enough.
I think that'd be really fun.
Yeah.
I don't know that we'll do another one, you know, certainly in the next few years. You know, I think we do need to focus on other things. But it's a balance, isn't it? It's about, you know, work where people literally directly see themselves on stage, and that's key. And it's about work that allows people to imagine worlds and ways of living and identities and ideas that they haven't had direct access to. And I think both those things have to happen hand in hand.
Just
to do one and not the other
would.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Right. Wrangling it back in to legacy. The last question I'm supposed to ask you is, so when you leave this place, and that place can be ETT or that place can be the world and wider astral plane, how would you like to leave it changed?
Oh gosh, that's a really, really challenging question, isn't it? I can see so many traps in it.
No traps.
No, I'm teasing. Oh gosh, I don't know. You know, one of the whole things I love about theatre is its ephemeralness. Is that is the way it's there, exists in its moment, and burns really brightly, and then does go, and it leaves room and space for the next person to come along.
Brilliant.
And,
tell me about that. No one's ever said that, and that's what I think. Say that.
Well, it just, for me, what it gives me as an artist, it gives you the ability to be totally present in it, in that moment of you as a group of people who are making that work and making it for that audience. And that gives you a freedom and an intention, which is really urgent. Mm. But equally, the freedom comes from the fact that it exists there and then it goes and disappears. Mm-hmm. And that space is then freed. And what's so exciting at the moment culturally is how much that space is being freed for other voices, for new things to come in and new conversations to be had. And that for me is the great strength of theatre, is its impermanence, mm-hmm. and is its ability to evolve and shape shift. And that's what the imagination is. And that's why for me, it's the art form that, you know, thus far I've wanted to sort of make my life in. So that it's the fact that it burns out and then is reborn again, that is so significant. And I think, so that's one thing. I mean, and then the other sort of thing is probably what I've said already, but it goes back to this idea of, why we tell stories, and this idea to understand people and, you know, and bits of cultures and ourselves and societies and all of that that we haven't lived, but that we can understand through telling stories. And I just think for me, that's the reason I sort of get up in the morning and the thing that really excites me. So to have done that a lot significantly, yes. hopefully, I think feels something that would, you know, would be proud of.
The ephemeral thing's interesting in that I have always felt like the thing that makes this precious is that it is but for a moment and then it's gone. So you get it and then poof. And I love that. And then the other day I went to Stonehenge with a friend from Canada who is being a tourist. And while he listened to the audio guide, I sort of sat on the grass and looked at Stonehenge. And I was sort of thinking about... Oh, I'm such a wanker. But I was sort of thinking about the relationship between the ephemeral and the eternal. Because the thing that is eternally true is that this too shall pass. And I was like, that... There's something... There's a real grace... To giving yourself up to disappearing.
I think there's a much greater connection between the eternal and the ephemeral than there perhaps first appears. And I think often we lived in this hyper capitalist time, so we're often led to believe that the eternal is actually about containing and controlling and having. And I think interestingly, a lot theatre is in a really interesting moment in its relationship to capitalism. I've literally just come back from America and I was at a basketball game, so forgive me what's really on my mind, but every single second of watching American sport, you are being distracted and entertained and sold to. And it really makes you aware of how that's basically true here as well. It's just slightly subtler. And what's so interesting, I think, about that in relation to theatre, which, as you say, is there and gone, that you can't control, and is an art form that, in the vast majority of cases, is sort of inherently anti-capitalist because it loses money.
And also, it's to be experienced, not consumed.
Yeah, exactly. And I think where our problems are at the moment is the fact that I think we're seeing it in the most capitalist terms. And I think that's causing a huge amount of pain for younger artists who are feeling it very inaccessible.
I'm a middle-aged artist and I have that pain. Yeah.
And just real, real difficulties in terms of some of the work we're making. And I think there's some really big questions we need to answer about what it is to make theatre in a capitalist society at the moment and what is it? Because... certainly, yeah. I mean, that's a whole other podcast.
And how we articulate value because we can only understand value now in economic terms.
Yeah.
And that is not where art sits.
Yeah.
At all. Unless you're Michelangelo, and then there's a whole other thing.
Yeah. Okay. But in theory, the great freedom we should have is that, unlike, say, art, for example, or fashion or other things, those are, you know, or film or television, those are industries which can make money for people. And so the influence is not really, apart from a few lucky people in the West End, let's say, it's not really. And that's, you know, that of course that creates issues, and that does create issues of access and who's able to make the work and roots into it, and the amount of work that's being made, the amount of people that want to do it versus the amount of opportunities there are. And that's why I mean, there's incredible difficulty out there. But I think there's possibly a way of flipping that on its head and also seeing where the real opportunities are within that and the freedom, maybe.
Because there's certainly a rebellion, right? You know, if this system is not your system, come and join us in the system that isn't this system.
Yeah.
Or come and join us, figure out what
and
the system
we've never
is.
Been that good at that in this country, as we know, compared to other places in Europe and stuff. And I wonder whether we need to a little bit. Yeah. I mean, the other answer to your legacy question, sort of born out of this question, is I think what's happening is really exciting in the industry, and I think these jobs, the time frame on them is getting shorter and shorter. And I think the other answer is that one leaves the company obviously in a better position, all that when you found it, whatever, but that you also you're creating an environment that the next artistic leaders that are coming through are able to truly represent the country, are able to be radical, are able to work in a framework that can start to answer some of these questions. That would be a tangible and really significant, I think, legacy.
Yeah. I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.